This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. A concussion is a traumatic brain injury that alters the way your brain functions and is common in contact sports like football. But new studies show more time may be needed to be sure a concussion heals. Student coaches are now required to complete training on recognizing and treating concussions and head injuries. Joining me to talk about concussions are the head of Christ Hospital's Sports Medicine Concussion Management Program, Dr. Edward Markeski. Director of the Division of Sports Medicine at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, Dr. Kelsey Logan, and clinic manager at St. Elizabeth Sports Medicine, certified athletic trainer and athletic trainer for Holy Cross High School, Scott Helton. You can join the discussion by calling us at 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Dr. Markeski, I'm going to start with you. Can you define what a concussion is?
Yes. I would say the easiest way to define it would be a chemical disturbance to the brain triggered by some mechanical force. That mechanical force doesn't have to be directly to the brain. It could actually be to the torso, but enough to cause a whiplash effect to the brain and injure the brain. Now, the concussion in sport group has defined this in medical terms as a complex pathophysiologic process affecting the brain, induced by traumatic biomechanical force. That group was a group of experts, physicians, clinicians, neuropsychiatrists that all convened internationally and came up with this unifying diagnosis.
You said something there that I've not heard before about the chemical reaction. I don't know that anyone, what's the chemical, how's the chemical reaction involved?
Basically, a concussion is similar, analogous, parallel to a seizure. However, you just don't see the motor activity of flailing arms or legs or extremities.
Well, what we think happens is that electrolytes become disturbed from the outside of the cell membrane to the inside of the cell membrane. And normally, those are electrolytes that are kept at very, very precise levels so that the cell can work. Well, if that disturbance is created at all, even a small portion of the cell's function, that cell just doesn't work. And what happens is you end up with what we call an energy crisis between the energy that a cell has to function and the energy the cell needs to function. And what we're learning about concussion, especially over the last several years, is that it takes much longer than we originally thought for that balance to come back into play so that we can have normal cell function again.
Scott, did you want anything?
Yeah, I think the thing to add, too, is just the complexity of this problem that we're talking about. And I think for many years, we didn't give it the respect and the attention that it quite deserved. And what I try to do when I'm talking with coaches and athletes and parents is to get them to understand that this is a real brain injury. And if you don't understand that we're talking about the brain here, then you're not going to give it the attention and respect it commands and potentially can lead to bad outcomes.
In addition to that cellular disturbance that is well characterized now, there is indiscriminate release of neuropeptides that are excitatory to the adjacent nerve cells. And that's what we see as this excitability trigger out of control that's analogous, again, to a seizure. Now, seizures can happen in a concussion or post-concussion. It's very rare. And if they do occur, you know, we usually treat it as a benign condition. That's something that someone's going to receive medication for to prevent seizure in the long run.
Well, it's interesting when you think about this, and certainly on a football field, if you're watching an NFL game and you see a player go down or in a baseball game and you just see him get hit in the head by a baseball, then you automatically think, well, a concussion is possible there. But how much force really does it take to be a concussion? Does it have to be just that wallop, or can it be just a simple blow to the head?
I think that's very interesting. I mean, as an athletic trainer on the sidelines of many sporting events over the years, it's amazing sometimes how small, seemingly small impacts can lead to concussion. Certainly the big ones do as well, but it doesn't always take a large impact for a concussion to occur.
Right. We used to think that it was just these big, oh my goodness, look at that hit, plays that cause concussion, but now we're learning that a variety across the spectrum of force hits can cause concussion. And what's really scary is that there's some recent data that shows even those low to moderate impact hits that may not even cause concussion symptoms may be tied to longer-term issues. We don't know that yet, and that's what's terrifying for those of us who treat especially younger kids, because we don't know what the threshold is, to be honest. So, for example, there was a study, a review that looked at all the impacts in high school and college sports studies and showed that fewer than 1% of the field impacts that they actually recorded appeared to place the athlete at risk for concussion. But these athletes, especially these high school athletes, were receiving on average of 22 head impacts per session, or that was a practice or a game, or 520 impacts per athlete per season. And that was in one study. The other one showed 6.5 impacts to the head every single day per week for 14 weeks. That's a lot of head injury. We just don't know how much is too much and where that threshold is.
Dr. Marquez.
You know, I would say that it's easy to pick up a concussion when it's a dramatic event that takes place on the field. Player goes down, is motionless. Concussion. That's easy to diagnose. The challenge comes when that doesn't happen. And that's by far and away the more common scenario that I, as a medical physician on the sidelines, has to deal with, where we have an athlete who is usually reported by his teammates as not following the right plays, confused in the huddle, or we'll even have coaches come up to us and say, "Doc, can you check him out? He doesn't seem right tonight." That's when the challenge of making a diagnosis on the sidelines is really the point of what we're doing here, is eliminate that athlete from any further risk if a concussion is diagnosed. Now, let's talk about G-forces. Just to inform our listeners today about G-forces, they're well characterized now in concussion. So just for comparison's sake, let's say a typical turn in a fighter jet is 9 to 12 Gs, okay? A parachutist during opening of the parachute, 33 Gs, okay? 100 G-force, a motor vehicle collision into a wall, that's at 62 miles per hour, okay? The forces that we see in concussion range from anywhere to 50 to 100, sometimes more. But not each of those G-forces or not each of those impacts cause a concussion, and not even in the same player. So what am I saying? Player A receives a hit of 70 Gs 1 week and does not have a concussion. But 2 weeks later, he receives a G-force of 50 and has a full-blown concussion. We don't understand the reason for that. Why is there vulnerability 2 weeks later that wasn't there a week ago? And there are thoughts as to why that is.
Well, all of the things that you all are saying makes me keep thinking of more and more questions. But one of the things I think we should address first is, does it matter where on the head a person is hit? I mean, I've heard it's the back of the head. Well, does it matter if it's the top of the head or the side of the head?
Yeah, so the studies that looked at these hits showed that it was more common to have concussion symptoms after a hit either to the front or the side or the top of the head.
Really? Not so much the back?
Yeah, not so much the back.
I would say the data that I'm familiar with that looks at these specific G-forces that are sensed by accelerometers in the helmet. So you can fit an athlete right now at this day and age with an accelerometer.
I don't know what that is.
Okay.
Tell me what that is.
It is basically a device that fits in a helmet that can, in real time, assess the gravitational forces of that hit. So when two people collide, in real time, we can assess the acceleration, the linear acceleration of that hit, the G-force of that hit. And regarding that G-force, the studies that are out there show that the top of the helmet is the main hit or the main cause for a hit that is associated with concussion. So top of the helmet. And what does that data allow us to do? So it allows us to tell the athlete, do not lead with your head and your helmet down. You're going to potentially provoke yourself a concussion.
Well, what does a trainer say about that? I mean, isn't that one of the ways that the players tend to play, is with their head out there?
Absolutely, and it's one of the things we work very closely with our athletes and our coaches for, is to help to educate and train and coach these kids to do things the right way. There's an entire program out there right now called Heads Up. for concussion, and it's to teach these youth athletes in particular to keep your head up when you're addressing your opponent to tackle them so that you don't lead with the top of the helmet and do the old spearing technique. So it's a very important thing, that, and I look for that all the time when I'm on a sideline and I see a kid do something and they get away with it. They're not injured, but I always use that as an opportunity to pull that kid over to the sideline and say, hey, this time it didn't cause a problem, but you need to keep that head up when you're tackling, and we're going to watch you, and I'm going to go tell his position coach to watch him. I'm going to talk to his mom and dad after the game and say, we need to teach this kid to do better, to do it the right way.
Dr. Logan?
And Marian, I wanted to get back to a point that you and Ed brought up a few minutes ago about the fact that even if we're able to look at these G-forces and look at these hits, what we're still not doing a great job of is identifying concussions on the sideline that are more subtle. I mean, Ed is exactly right. When we have somebody who's stumbling around after a hit, it's not real hard for anybody to tell that that person's altered and confused, and they probably have a concussion and they don't need to be playing anymore. It's those smaller, more subtle symptoms that we have trouble with. As physicians, we have trouble. As athletic trainers, we have trouble unless we know the child very, very well. And there was a study that looked at kids and their parents and how well that they could tell whether or not there were symptoms of a concussion. About 3/4 of parents and children who knew what a concussion was still missed a scenario that had subtle concussion signs in it. Most of them got the obvious concussion, right? We would all get that. Kids stumbling around, can't speak correctly, going to the wrong sideline, those types of things. But those are the easy ones to get. And if we miss the subtle ones, these are the kids who are going to keep going back in the game over and over and over, potentially getting more hits, more impacts when the brain is in a very vulnerable position.
Well, how do you even begin to diagnose on the sidelines? I mean, like you said, the obvious ones, but these minor situations, do they have to go in? I mean, do you do an MRI on these kids? I mean, what do you do?
We have protocols. I mean, most programs at this day and age, athletic trainers, athletic departments of high schools and at higher levels all have a protocol. For instance, in the NFL, they are now introducing an iPad onto the sidelines as of this year so that they can run through their iPad questionnaire and document what was done. Not only that, they're able to retrieve that same data from prior to the season starting and allow them to directly compare things like how they scored on their balance, how their memory function for words was preseason versus on the sidelines against Dallas last night. So it's becoming very sophisticated. And there are tools that we use called the sideline concussion assessment tools, things that are promoted by the CDC that are basically protocol standards of care for evaluating concussion on the sideline. And we can walk through that if we want.
And a lot of that management really starts preseason. What we've tried to do over the last several years is we do a lot of baseline testing in the office where we give the kids an opportunity to come in. We do a balance test so that we know what normal is for a certain athlete. Not everyone's balance is the same, of course. So when I test a kid post-concussion on a sideline or in the office with one of our physicians or with myself, we can compare that to what their norm is exactly, and we do the same thing with some neuropsychological testing as well, and that can be very helpful. And not to mention, it also gives us an opportunity preseason to increase the awareness, to help educate the athlete, the coach, the parent. This is what we're looking for if a concussion should occur, and that I think is paramount to our success.
Well, and I don't want the listeners, though, to get the idea that we only use a test, right? Because we all know that there's not a concussion test, okay, Marian? There's just not something that we can just do and say, yep, you're concussed, or no, you're fine. It's really looking at the whole athlete, and the main part of our concussion diagnosis, still with all the science that we have, is still how does the athlete feel? Mm-hmm. Clinical symptoms, headache, confusion, feeling of being foggy or dizzy or just not quite right. And so obviously, if we haven't seen that athlete before and don't know how they normally are, it might be a little bit more difficult to discern that. And that's when these tests that we're talking about are very, very helpful. But for the most part, it's really questioning that athlete on the sideline, observing how they're acting, asking them some questions and seeing how they're doing.
When you talk about, we're talking about this now, and I think we're all sort of thinking of football, maybe not, but what about other sports? I mean, are other sports as dangerous? I think football's one that a head hit is common.
basically, you want to think about the sports in categories. There are the collision sports. So in that category, football, obviously, number one. Number two and closely behind is going to be hockey. Hockey is a major, major contact sport that causes concussion. And then you're going to talk about your contact sports. So what are your contact sports? The big ones there are going to be lacrosse and soccer. Okay, those are the major sports that we're going to see concussion. Baseball, you can see it from time to time. It's
wrestling,
it's fairly atypical. I mean, sure. So anything that's contact, anything that's collision, you're going to see concussion. And in the collision sports, they're going to be at higher rates. Okay.
What about kids that don't play team sports but like to ride their bike? You know,
yeah.
I just had a big argument with my daughter that, you know, she needs to wear a helmet no matter what. And she said, I'm only going to be on our street. And I tried to explain the pavement's just as hard on our street as it is all around the neighborhood.
Right.
How important is something like a bike helmet? I mean, is that something you say yes to?
Well, bicycling, when you look at pediatric studies from emergency departments, bicycling is right up there with football as far as the number of concussions that are sustained.
Really?
Yeah. So, My mantra to my young patients is no helmet, no bicycle, no helmet, no scooter. You know,
well, especially when you're talking about the extreme risks that exist in some of those activities. And helmets are wonderful, obviously, for the catastrophic. I mean, not just the concussion to your son or daughter, but very extreme things can happen. And helmets have done a wonderful job in preventing those things.
And I'll just pick up on the topic of if we want to shift towards just helmet technology and protection of helmets. Now, I will say at this point in time where the state of technology exists, there is no helmet device, no helmet gear that exists internationally to prevent concussion.
So they only...
Bottom line.
So they just help... Well, not the word prevent. What's the word you would use? What they do?
Might
protect a little?
Reduce the risk potentially is a word that you could maybe use.
Maybe
minimize. Mm-hmm. But it does not prevent a concussion. And that's a misconception that people have. Families, I'm looking for the right helmet. I'm looking for the right helmet that's going to prevent the concussion. Unfortunately, the top rated helmets that are out there, the top five, are basically all the same. And none of them are going to completely prevent a concussion. It's just not possible. Your brain floats within, protected by the skull, okay? And it's, you can't fix something that's floating to the skull. It's just not possible.
Well, I was going to say, one of the very interesting things that's come out as well with some of the helmet technology is it can lead to more dangerous play because they get this false sense of security, especially in sports like soccer, helmets aren't quite as prevalent.
We're going to continue our discussion. There's a lot to say today. We're talking about concussions. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100. You can email us, talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter. We'll talk more about equipment and just treatment when we continue our discussion in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition. We're talking today about concussions on Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. My guests are head of Christ Hospital's Sports Medicine Concussion Management Program, Dr. Edward Markeski, director of the Division of Sports Medicine at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, Dr. Kelsey Logan, and clinic manager at St. Elizabeth Sports Medicine, certified athletic trainer and athletic trainer for Holy Cross High School, Scott Helton. We'd like to hear from you, too. You can call us, 513-419-7100. Or email us, talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. And this is coming from Jonathan on Facebook, who says, do the guests know about the Guardian Caps football helmet cover, and do they think they are effective?
Yes, I think we probably all know about the Guardian Caps. Yeah, so
what are they?
Yeah, so it's basically a really thick foam that covers a regular football helmet. And this was designed by a chemical engineer and is marketed. The tests that are reported for the Guardian Cap decrease some of the force transmitted to the helmet. Again, this is the same problem that we have with all helmet studies, that decreased force transmitted through the helmet does not mean decreased concussions. We can't put padding where it really needs to go, between the skull and between the brain. So there are some... College teams who are using this. In fact, the report I showed yesterday was from the University of South Carolina is going to start using this in their practices. But for all intents and purposes, this invalidates the safety of the helmet because it's not been tested by NOCSI, which is the certifying agency for football helmets. And we don't know what can happen for this. So in no way would I ever tell a young athlete that they need to wear this.
You said something really interesting, that the best place to protect is to put padding between the skull and the brain. And is that really why even a shake will cause a concussion? Because really it's just things moving around in your head, not so much where you get hit, but what that hit causes to shake inside?
Right. It's that right. It's that whiplash mechanism that causes what we call a contra coup mechanism of injury, and the brain shakes inside the head as a result of that back and forth quick acceleration deceleration force. And that's why you see a lot of blindsided hits leading to concussion, because they're not prepared for the hit. They get blindsided, the neck whips, and the brain is jarred inside the skull.
You know, I'll just add that, again, the helmets and their technology today will not prevent a concussion fully. And helmets were designed to prevent the fracture of the skull, and that's what they do excellently. I mean, with foolproof, they prevent fractures to the skull, which potentially could be life-threatening, as a concussion could be if not managed correctly. But again, that's what they're designed to do, and that's what they do well. Now, when it comes to these variables that to help explain why, you know, an athlete on 1 week sustains a higher G-force and has a concussion, but 2 weeks later, a lower G-force or a higher G-force and doesn't have a concussion. You know, things like the amount of fluid volume that we're talking about, the space between the brain and the skull. There's variabilities there from day to day, week to week, that could make a difference. There's also intra-individual fluctuations in cerebral blood flow that could explain for this. So a lot of variables and factors that we really can't account for.
Again, if you have a question, you can email us, talk@wvxu.org. You'll find us on Facebook at 91.7 WVXU or on Twitter at 917 WVXU. On the phone right now, Charles from College Hill. Good afternoon, Charles.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon to your guests.
Thank you.
I was just wondering, what would be the appropriate recovery time once a concussion has been diagnosed? Or is there a certain amount of time that the child should be held from an activity, or just that question, basic question, what is the recovery period like? And I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Well, thank you for your call, Charles.
Yeah, this is an absolutely great question. It's one of the most common questions that I get from parents. Well, to be honest, I don't know from day one. I don't know how long a concussion is going to last from one person to the other. We have very few prognostic factors that let us know, well, this is going to last 10 days versus 20 days versus 4 weeks. And in fact, we used to try to put concussion patients in little categories where we could say, okay, you're out for a week, you're out for 2 weeks, you're out for a month. All that has gone by the wayside because it was not based on science at all. So now, what we try to promote to the family is that there is a concept. We need to have symptoms fully gone with rest and with all the exertion that you'd normally do, whether that's school or sport, whatever. And also, as best we can tell, your brain needs to be returned to its normal function. And that's when we get to some of the testing that we were discussing before as to ways we can tell when somebody's back to their normal. That's really difficult in younger children because we don't have those tests that are validated. And so mostly we're still going on symptom report, and we are typically more conservative with those kids. Anecdotally, I'll tell you, for kids who are in elementary school or about age 12 and younger, we're usually seeing somewhere upwards of 4 weeks for recovery. As you move on to the older ages, junior high, you're looking at more 2 to 3 weeks, high school around 2 weeks, and the college age, 1 to 2 weeks. Again, those are from studies that we have, but it's not hard and fast. And we don't understand fully why it may take one person a week to recover and one person 6 weeks to recover.
I think I totally agree. And I think the key point to understand is that the management is becoming individualized to each and every patient. No two concussions are the same, and no two concussions in the same athlete are the same. So we use all the information gathering that we have. But the bottom line is it's individual. The treatment will be individual for that patient. And basically the guidelines, or basically the time frames of healing, are usually more in our younger athletes. And that's who we're concerned about. They represent the vast majority of people participating in organized sports. The NFL players, they represent a microcosm to that. And that's who we need to be concerned about, because those brains are immature and they're more vulnerable to poor outcomes.
What about when there's multiple concussions? You've had one concussion. Okay, now you're back on the field. Maybe it's even 6 months later, but another concussion occurs. Do they become more dangerous as there are more of them to the same person?
Oh, I think certainly they do. That's one of the things we worry about quite a bit with these kids. And you also see that second concussion, and if you get beyond that, the third, and hopefully not the fourth, but when that does occur, the threshold becomes so much lower. You know, the first concussion took a big hit to happen. The next time they took a seemingly minor, normal, you know, blow to the body, nothing extreme whatsoever, and their concussion symptoms returned. The third time, their symptoms returned with potentially just doing running drills on the field with no, you know, just the impact of their body hitting the ground multiple times. So it's something that we address quite regularly.
Yeah, Scott's right. And used to, I would say that someone retiring from concussion-related issues was really rare. Now, I would say it's not so rare because of exactly the point that you brought up, is that it seems that less force over time tends to bring on these concussion symptoms. Mm-hmm. And you know what? To be honest, we still don't know who is more likely to have that lower threshold for a concussion versus someone else. Some people's brains can take a lot of force, and they can take it over and over and over. I've had soccer players who've had 10 concussions, and they all recover within a week or two. And I've had some athletes who have just two, and they don't recover at all. It's really frightening. And again, we don't know where that threshold is for each person until they're there.
I would also say that you could have one concussion and be done. And so if you have one concussion and you have structural injury to the brain that's visible on some of our basic imaging scans, like an MRI. Usually, an MRI is going to be totally normal. Again, we talked about it being as a chemical disturbance. Why would you see a chemical disturbance on an MRI? You're not. But if you do, you know that that's a bad thing. And if they're suffering concussion symptoms and now suffering something called post-concussion syndrome, where the symptoms are now lingering well beyond the injury, like a month, 2 months later, that's going to be real cause for pause.
You talked about retiring, you know, and that means that's it for the rest of their lives? That means that's it through high school? What does that mean?
It's hard to talk about with a 15-year-old kid, you know.
Seriously, I mean,
it's...
Yeah, the rest of their lives is a statement that I'm not willing to make, but for the foreseeable competitive future, meaning years, that person should not be hitting their head. And, you know, it's really not about the sport. It's about hitting their head again. I mean, I really don't care what sport it is. It's just I don't want you having an insult to your brain again, because that's going to impact your academic future, your future to have the job you want, to have the life that you want, to have the family that you want. We're not talking just about sport. And, you know, none of us take these issues lightly at all. No one is quick to make a judgment and say, oh, your next concussion, you're done. It's not like that. It's very, very individualized, and we take into account the entire impact on this patient's life.
You talked about how some, when they don't recover, what does that mean, they don't recover? What happens?
Imagine having a headache for every day, mm-hmm. maybe all day, not being able to concentrate in class, not being able to get your work done, having to read things over and over and over to get it, not being able to look at computer screens for very long. I'm talking 15 minutes and getting a headache. And imagine this going on for 6 months, 9 months, a year.
Does it ever go away?
Sure.
So it's not going to be the rest of their lives they're going to have that headache. But if that lasts that long,
for almost all people, the symptoms over time are going to get better. I can't tell a person that it's going to get fixed. I don't know that. But in general, without another head injury, over time, things will get better.
The other important point to make is it's not just being diagnosed with a concussion. There are several athletes out there that, with repetitive head trauma, though never diagnosed clinically with what we're talking about as a concussion, they are suffering ill effects to their brain in terms of how that brain functions, like concentration, emotion. So if you look at, for instance, studies among the NFL retired athletes, there is a much higher incidence of attentional deficit disorder in those retired athletes versus the general population in the same age and same kind of age group and makeup as an individual.
Well, you heard about the baseball player Ryan Friel, who had had numerous concussions and then reportedly commit suicide not that long ago, and some blame it on that. Do you think it could get to the point where it could cause that kind of a reaction in someone who's had severe concussions?
So, you know, the incidence of suicide, depression, and attentional deficit disorder are high among retired NFL athletes. And in the brains that have been studied to date, I think there are 151 cases that have been studied to date of postmortem diagnosis of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is the end stage of brain trauma, whether concussion, not concussion, or just brain trauma from hitting each other several times over and over for several years. You see a higher incidence of these things.
Now, we hear this and we know it's serious, and I think we all understand that we're all adults. When you start talking to 10 and 12 and 15-year-olds who really see themselves as invincible, Scott, how do they take this? Are they ready to say, okay, I'll be more careful, I'll do this? Are they serious about it? Does it depend on the kid?
Oh, it absolutely depends on the kid, and I think it depends on the parents as well. You know, you really want to have a parent that's engaged in making intelligent decisions. The kids are hard. Like you said, they do see themselves as invincible, and they certainly don't want to see themselves as having to retire from anything. You know, they want to do more all the time. So there's a great challenge there that we have to make sure that we get the kid involved and to the best of our ability, help the child to understand what's going on. And one of the things that's very challenging with that is kids are smart. They'll figure out, well, all I have to do is tell this doctor that I feel okay, and that's how my friend got to go back and play soccer again. So I'll just tell them that I'm okay. So we really have to work to help them understand the severity and the reason that we're looking out for them.
Our number is 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation.
And I think, though, as the years have gone on and concussion has become much more popular in the lay press, we're seeing less and less of that resistance as long as we take the time to educate the patient and their family. Right. You know, unlike other sports injuries, we can't put a cast on the brain and make it rest. We can't give you a pill that's going to make the brain work better. We really don't have any sort of significant, objective, quick treatment to do anything for this. And so in a concussion visit, we all spend a significant amount of time going through all the things that we've talked about today, going through the pathophysiology of how the brain works and why concussion interrupts that, and go through all those things to help the family understand really what's going on so that we can then form our treatment plan and we have more buy-in and more participation from the student athlete.
What about coaches? Are they willing to take it seriously?
Well, some are and some are not, and that's why there's concussion legislation for the most part.
Right. Tell us about that. What is the legislation?
So, as you all know, it was enacted this year in April, became law, and is in effect. And the Ohio Department of Education has done a wonderful job at creating some educational resources on their website that go through what the concussion legislation states. And very simply, what it is a several-pronged approach to try to improve the health of kids who are playing sports. And this involves both scholastic sports in high school and in junior high, as well as youth sports. So all coaches who want to supervise a team have to go through an online training program, either through the National Federation of High School Sports or through the CDC's concussion program. And these are online resources that take not quite an hour to do. They're free. You just have to have a valid email address and they'll send you a completion statement. But you have to have that, and it has to be updated every 3 years for you to maintain your coach's license. It also provides that coaches and referees who have this training are going to need to pull those athletes off the field if they suspect that there could have been a concussion sustained.
John from Cincinnati on the phone. Well, your question, please.
Well, my understanding is that a person's frontal cortex isn't even completely wired up until they're on the order of about 25 years old.
That's right.
So I guess that would make it, A, much more difficult to get young people to understand the fact that they are not invincible and immortal. And the other thing, I guess, would concussions even further delay or damage that
process,
completion of that wiring?
Sure.
So it's an excellent point. And, you know, what he's referring to is, you know, maturation of the brain or maturing of the brain, which is basically myelination of the brain fibers. OK, and that process is not complete in our youth athletes. And so, you know, when you have these youngsters, you know, sustaining head collisions, you know, they have disproportionately sized heads for their body. They're like the bobbleheads that you see at the baseball game. So they have disproportionately sized heads for their bodies, and they have very weak neck muscles. And that's a perfect setup for head for adverse effects from head trauma.
Yeah, I would agree. I think one of the mistakes we can make at times is making the assumption that these children that we work with are miniature adults. They're not. Their anatomy is developing. I mean, even in simple, you know, seemingly simple bone injuries, we have to be aware that this is not an adult just in a smaller frame.
And Bob from Avondale, time about 20 seconds. Can you be real quick?
Yes. I just wondered why we should think of this, that is participating in sport for recreation and such, is any different than using a drug for recreation. It sounds like the sport is just as dangerous.
Comments?
Well, think about
Bob, thank you.
Think about sport and recreation, all the wonderful benefits that it has for our children psychologically, physically, emotionally. They're learning how to develop both individual and team skills. None of us are saying that we don't want kids to participate in sports. We love sports. We love watching and participate in sports. We want our children to be able to do the same thing safely.
Thank you all for joining us. We've been talking today about concussions. My guest, the head of Christ Hospital Sports Medicine Concussion Management Program, Dr. Edward Markeski, director of the Division of Sports Medicine at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, Dr. Kelsey Logan, and clinic manager at St. Elizabeth Sports Medicine Certified Athletic Trainer, Scott Helton. Cincinnati Edition is produced by Pete Reitmeier. Today's technical director was Bruce Ellis. I'm Marianne Zalesnik.